Welcome to another episode of the Red Pill Blue Blood podcast. I started this podcast to explain my thoughts about some of the narratives and policies BYU has been advocating, and as a space to hear others who have the same concerns as I. But there was a third goal that I wanted to accomplish with this podcast. I wanted to have a place where people could hear those with opposing views come together to have discussions, in good faith, on topics that are relevant on campus, but which so often only get discussed in our own echo chambers. After asking and being rejected by several professors and groups, I was pleased that Nate Bird, the president of the Black Student Union at BYU, agreed to come on. We had a great discussion about the priesthood ban, recent comments by Brother Brad Wilcox on the topic, and the prevalence or lack of a racial hierarchy in the church and the USA. I'm excited for you to hear it. First, I want to encourage you to share this with others if you find that this is a useful part of the dialogue that's been happening in BYU in earnest over the past few years. I appreciate it. I also want to briefly apologize for the sound. There was only one mic in the BYU sound booth that was working, so it is what it is. It's manageable, though. With that, though, let's get into it. I'm Luke Hansen, and this is Red Pill Blue Blood. Welcome to a new episode. I'm super happy today to be here with Nate Bird. He's the president of the Black Student Union here at BYU, and I've been for a while trying to get somebody to come on who might have a little bit of different perspective just so we can talk about it. So I'm really glad you came on today. Thanks for coming.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
How about you just start off by telling us a little bit about where you come from, what brought you to BYU, what you do in the Black Student Union, just that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. So my name is Nate Bird. I'm from Michigan. I came out to BYU in 2014, and I've been out here kind of ever since. But I came out here to study psychology, and really, I was just kind of always encouraged to come to BYU because it was a like a church school, get a good education, and a good spiritual education as well. I guess I've kind of found that to be a little bit different than what I've actually experienced here. But I'm the president of the Black Student Union as well, and this is actually my second time as president of the Black Student Union. Before that, I was vice president of advertising, and really I just kind of help coordinate activities with members of the Black Student Union, help find other Black students on campus who are in need of some community, some fellowship, and just do outreach for them as well. And yeah, that's kind of the main things. I served a mission in Houston from 2016 to 2018. Got back, got married to my wonderful wife in 2020, and yeah.
So the Black Student Union, you say it's like an outreach type of thing. What kind of things do you do with it?
So yes, it's outreach. It's also events, activities, and community. So we provide basically support and just like a means of community for the Black students on campus, anyone who wants it. Really, the university doesn't have any resources for Black students, and so Black Student Union fulfills that role.
Mm-hmm. And you're an official university club?
Yes.
Gotcha. Well, nice. And so I guess you're focused more on the activities and community, whereas something like the BYU Anti-Racism Club is more focused on learning, I guess you would say, kind of more for a not Black student type of audience.
We cover all aspects. Community obviously is the first priority, but we also educate. We organize events to promote awareness and anti-racism, all those kinds of things. I mean, we do it all. Like literally anything that you could, anything that you would expect a university to do in regards to diversity and inclusion, BYU Black Student Union has done that.
Got it. So you said a little earlier that you had always planned on coming to BYU, and then when you got here, some things were a little different than you expected that they might be. Did I get that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Could you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Yeah. So initially, my experience, I didn't really know what to expect as far as culture-wise, but never having been to Utah, everybody told me, oh, this is, you know, it's like the promised land. It's this super holy place. When you go to BYU, everybody's very spiritual and this and that. And then when I got here, my first roommate was, you know, sneaking over to the girls' dorms every night, right? And so I was like, mm-hmm. What is this? This is not what I expected and what I've come to expect from BYU. And so there was a bit of a culture shock just adjusting to the fact that people in Utah are regular people, just like everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I kind of had like an elevated perception or an elevated ideal of what Utah was supposed to be. So it took some adjusting to that. And then also, there's a lot less diversity in Utah than there would be in a place like Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so getting used to that. And then also, because there's so much less diversity, there's also a greater quantity of ignorance because there's a lot less people who have experienced an environment that isn't just white and Mormon, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people who grew up here grew up in the same environment. They've never had their ideals or their beliefs challenged. And so they tend not to know a lot about other people's beliefs, other people's cultures, other people's ideas. And so while I have experienced racism in Utah, I would say that...
Hold on, you said you haven't?
I have.
Oh, you have.
Yeah,
okay.
I've definitely experienced racism in Utah. There's a lot of blatant racism, but I think there's also a lot of people who are ignorant and don't mean to be, you know, like they're not hostile or they don't mean to be actively racist or anything like that, but just their ignorance kind of promotes that behavior.
Mm-hmm. I think this would be a good time to segue into what got us in contact with each other. Was I had seen you make some statements about this thing with Brother Wilcox that happened 5 days ago or so. Mm-hmm. We're recording this on Valentine's Day, the 14th. So I think it was about the 9th of February. And there was kind of a big, I guess you could say Twitter kind of exploded over this to an extent, but also BYU put out a statement and even Brother Wilcox put out a statement after this. So I want to make sure I get it right, that we quote him fully here. So I've transcribed kind of the whole paragraph that this sentence that people had a problem with was embedded in. So I'm just going to start from the beginning and read through it, and then we can respond to it. So he says, "Sadly, you live in a time where people get uptight about priesthood issues. It's one of the most glorious things we have in the church, and yet people want to sit and fight about it and get uptight about it. Now, I don't mean to oversimplify a complex issue, but I sure think we make it a little harder than it needs to be." And then he goes into kind of like a combative voice, and he says, "How come the Blacks didn't get the priesthood until 1978? What's up with that, Brother Wilcox? What, Brigham Young was a jerk? Members of the church were prejudiced?" And then he pauses here and he says, "Maybe we're asking the wrong question. Maybe instead of asking, why did the Blacks have to wait until 1978, maybe we should ask, why did the whites and other races have to wait until 1829? Why did the Gentiles have to wait until after the Jews? And why did everybody in the house of Israel except the Levites have to wait?" When you look at it like that, then instead of trying to figure out God's timeline, we can just be grateful. Grateful down to our socks that the Blacks did receive the priesthood in 1978, and grateful down to our socks that Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery had the priesthood restored to them in 1829. And then he moves on to other stuff. It was specifically that, or at least what I saw people quoting was, it was specifically the sentence that people had the biggest problem with was the one where he said, "Why did Blacks have to wait until 1978? Maybe we should ask, why did the whites and other races have to wait until 1829? So I saw a couple of your comments on this. And just before I read this, you talked about racism versus ignorance. What category would you put this into?
I would put this mainly into,
I guess,
ignorance.
You could give it like a percentage.
Yeah.
You say mainly ignorance?
They work together. I would say this would probably be 70%, 65% ignorance, 45%, or was it? No, that's wrong math. 35% racism. Right?
Yeah. I was going to go with you on it. I wouldn't have even.
I have to say, your Brad Wilcox impersonation is pretty spot on.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Just the way you said it. But okay. I think, I don't think that Brad Wilcox has any, you know, bears any ill will toward Black members of the church.
Is it okay if I pause you right there?
Yeah, that's fine.
Because you say, like, maybe there's a certain percentage racism. Mm-hmm. So if you say he doesn't have any ill will, then, like, what are you defining racism as? Because I kind of... Okay, you were going to go into that.
So how would you define racism?
Okay, I would define racism as any sort of belief. And then, of course, you can express your beliefs in words and actions. But a belief that somebody or a group of people is inferior because of their race. Intrinsically tied to their race. Like, maybe you could say, oh, Asians are good at math, or Asians could say white people aren't as good at math. Mm-hmm. But that's based on, like, actual statistical data.
Right.
So I'd say those things aren't racism. But if you just purely are basing some sort of premise on race alone, then that's racism.
Gotcha.
How would you define it?
My definition would be pretty similar. I would add to it that there are multiple kinds of racism, right? There's, there's benevolent racism, which is, you know, it's kind of like this nice approach to racism. Like, for instance, you know, I've had a lot of people come up to me and tell me things about their time in Africa, you know, to be white people. I've never been to Africa.
Right? I actually went there on my mission.
I've gotten things like that where people will just assume that, you know, I want to know everything about their experience in Africa because I'm a black American, right? But I don't know anything about that experience. And so, you know, that's a form of racism where it's just kind of these associations that people make in their minds that aren't necessarily correct. There's racism that comes through ignorance, just beliefs that people may hold, kind of like you said. Obviously, there's the kind of racism that people tend to associate most commonly with the overall idea of racism, which is, you know, racial violence, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, you know, all those kinds of things, slavery, right? Those were very deliberate, very blatant forms of racism, but there's a lot of subtlety in racism now. And it's, there's racism that's institutional, meaning it's built into the systems that we have. So there's a lot of different kinds of racism. But in this instance, the reason that I say it was only, you know, say 35% racist is because, again, I don't think that Brad Wilcox was, you know, giving this talk specifically to say, I don't like black people, and so I'm going to voice these opinions. But he, in his ignorance, he took some ideas and some opinions that had no doctrinal basis, no scriptural foundation, and has been saying them for several years, right? And so he's promoting racist ideas, and it's because of his ignorance, right? And we can talk more about, you know, the scriptural and doctrinal aspects of that, but did you have any other questions for me before?
I guess I'm just trying to figure out, because you say racism of ignorance can happen if people think you're going to be really interested in hearing about Africa, or maybe thinking that you've been there, something like that. And I'm just trying to distinguish what racism would mean versus a stereotype would mean. Like, if somebody were to ask, were somebody were to say, oh, you're a Mormon, so you come from a family of, like, six kids. So, like, that's kind of the same type of ignorance, like assuming things based on a person. So I'm just like, where's the line between a stereotype and racism then?
That's a difficult question, because, you know, stereotypes can be a form of racism, right? Depending on how they're presented. Like, obviously there are people who are truly ignorant and maybe just don't know. And if that's the case, then yes, they're ignorant, but also they got those ideas from somewhere, right? They didn't just, they weren't born with those ideas. So they came from some kind of idea. And the thing with racism against African-American people is that it's so complex because it goes back so far, right? The whole idea of race was invented as a justification for slavery, right? Because before then, there weren't qualifications of black, white, you know, red, yellow, what have you. But it started with phrenology, where they said, well, African people have different shaped heads, therefore they are less superior. And then it morphed into...
I'm talking like IQ type of thing?
Basically. I mean, this was back in like the 1700s. They didn't really have IQ and stuff then. But yeah, they said that because black people had a certain shape of their head, that meant that they were less superior, or they were inferior to white people, because white people had a different shaped head. And they said, oh, the Mongoloids and the Negroids and the Caucasians, you know, like they had these different classifications for Native Americans, Asians, black people, right? And they kind of ranked them. And of course, white people were at the top of that. And I think black people were at the very bottom, and then in between were Asians and Native Americans. So there's so much that goes into racism and into those stereotypes. And all of them were invented as a means of kind of continuing that subjugation, right? Continuing the false ideas around black people. So to answer your question as to where the line is between ignorance, between stereotypes, and between racism, I would say that a lot of times it depends on the intent of the person. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to, you know, to move past a racist comment or to move past an ignorant comment, as long as someone is willing to learn from that and then to not make that mistake over and over again. Mm-hmm. From Brad Wilcox, maybe he just hasn't learned from it yet, but this is a mistake that he's made multiple times. Right? And having a PhD in teaching the religion department, that's not really, you know, you don't have room for error there. Mm-hmm.
So what would you have liked to see instead from him?
For one, I would have loved to see him crack open a scripture. I listened to the full talk, and from what I can remember, he didn't open the scriptures or reference the scripture a single time. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is where the room for error creeps in, because if he had used the scriptures and if he had used the things that he studied in college or in school, then he probably wouldn't have made those same mistakes. He probably wouldn't have been repeating the same untruths over and over again over the last several years. So that's honestly the biggest thing. As a religion professor, there should be no excuse for not using the scriptures. And it's not just him. If you go to other colleges where they teach theology, they always teach from the scriptures. You know, it's never just opinions. And I think at BYU, there's a habit of teaching more opinions than there is teaching from the scriptures, at least in a lot of the classes that I've been in. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Would you have liked to see something specific? Because you listen to the whole talk, so you understand he's covering a lot of different stuff on the gospel.
Yes, and there are a lot of problematic things that he said in that talk.
Yeah, I mean, people have brought that up, but we have a limited time, so right. I do want to, not that I don't think those other things are important, but just to keep it focused. Because, looking at this, he does mention, Christ at the time of the Gentiles didn't get it till after Christ ascended to heaven, and the apostles were teaching, and he also does mention that only the Levites had it. So there is kind of, not direct quotes, but references to scripture, so what do you think would have been needed to put this fully in context, in your opinion?
So in that instance, what he said was, yes, he gave references to scriptural occasions, but he referenced them incorrectly. Right? Those were, for instance, saying that the Levite, why did only the Levites get the priesthood? The thing is, that was always how it was from the beginning. Right? No one had the priesthood. And then the Lord said, the Levites have been set aside to hold, to work in the temple, to hold the priesthood.
It's like an actual revelation.
Exactly.
Policy.
Right? He gave that to Moses, and that was how it was from the beginning. The difference with the priesthood ban, and this is where he goes wrong, the difference with the priesthood ban is that we had the priesthood in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Joseph Smith was given the priesthood in 1829 with Oliver Cowdery. 1830, the church was established. 1836, the first black man receives the priesthood.
Elijah Abel, correct?
I'm not sure if it was Elijah Abel. I believe
he's
that's
just
correct.
The most famous one, though.
There were a few different ones. Elijah Abel was a member of the 70 at one point, right? And then it was only in 1852, that Brigham Young suddenly decides, black people can't have the priesthood anymore. And there was no revelation, there's no written document, there's no anything that says that this was something that came from God. This was just a decision that Brigham Young made. And, there are a lot of reasons, speculations as to why he made that decision, but the main reason is racism. And, Brigham Young himself said that he was a firm believer in slavery, right? He promoted it over the pulpit. So it wasn't that way from the beginning. Right? So you can't use that reference to say, the Levites only had the priesthood, and so this is why. Because we had the priesthood in the beginning, and then it was taken away from us by a man. Not by God, but by a man. Mm-hmm. For him to be a religion professor and to be touting ideas like that are just doctrinally and scripturally unsound, it's not okay. Right? So I would have liked to see him actually know what he was talking about as a BYU religion professor and as someone who's been speaking for a few decades now. Mm-hmm.
Would you have preferred, let's say he brings up that a lot of people have a problem with blacks getting the priesthood until 1978, and he says, we don't know the reasons. We don't completely know the reasons why this happened, and we also don't know why it took so long. But the kind of like the Lord's ways are not your. Well, no, that would be bad, because then you would make it seem like the Lord approved of it. I should have come up with this before. I guess saying that there have been times, there's not that they're the same, but there's other times when
things have seemed to take a long time before people got certain blessings that they didn't have before. And the reasons for all of those aren't all explained.
So are you asking?
Do you have a specific way this would be worded that you wouldn't then have a problem with it?
Yes. If he was being honest, if the church was being honest about this, then the best explanation would be, well, why didn't the blacks get the priesthood? What's up with that, Brother Wilcox? It was because it was racist. Right. Brigham Young made a decision based on his ideas at the time, and it was an incorrect decision, and it took 126 years to correct that decision. Right. Obviously, there was a point when the Lord said, you know, it's time to give the blacks back the priesthood. I don't know why that was in 1978, why it wasn't sooner than that. Mm-hmm. Probably because the church itself wasn't quite ready for that. Right? There are plenty of people in the church, even now, who still, you know, hold racist ideas, racist beliefs. And so perhaps it would have been even more damaging to the church if it had happened sooner. I'm not really sure the full reasons for that. It was wrong. It should never have happened in the first place, but it did. But yeah, I think just honesty and transparency on the church's part would do a lot to absolve these kinds of ideas from being perpetuated. Right? Because the whole reason that he can say something like this is because the church has never openly and honestly and transparently just made a full statement saying this was wrong. This is something we should not have done. We apologize for it. We're going to do something to make it better. Right? Mm-hmm. They released the essay on race and the priesthood that was written by Darius Gray, right? So they published that, I think, on the church's website. And that's a wonderful resource. If you haven't read it, I want you to check it out. But I'm sure you have. But yeah, there's just never been any open, honest, transparent communication from the church about this, which is why these things continue to happen.
I've read the Race and the Priesthood one. I do appreciate that it says people used to think it was the seed of Cain, and also that it was premortal life choices that were the reason for this. And the church is absolutely not. That's not true. They taught it back then, and it's not true. So they have refuted that, but you'd also like them to say, and also it came up purely because of racism?
And as far as the church refuting it, I believe it was in the Race and the Priesthood essay where they said we disavow these previous teachings or something like that. They use the word disavow, right? But the issue with that is, yeah, they disavowed it in a written publication, but standing up in general conference, which is where everyone would hear it, those things have not been, that hasn't been disavowed enough, right? Because obviously it takes some repetition for these things to go away. And since people are still teaching these kinds of ideas, not just Brad Wilcox, but other people. You know, I've had multiple people talk to me about the seed of Cain. On my mission, someone called me a fence sitter, which goes back to the whole idea.
I think that was a quote from
McConkie. And, you know, there's still a lot of those ideas floating around out there, and it's because they have not been fully and publicly disavowed as they should have been. So we say it, yeah, we don't believe in those things anymore, but clearly members of the church still believe those things. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder, though, because it was only in about 1970, and I think it was 1973, that people actually were able to find, because these were like some olds, that was like a Wilford Woodruff journal was where the 1852 announcement from Brigham Young came. Like, that's where they found that piece. So up until about 1970, people in the church, including the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve, didn't know where it came from. They just assumed that it came from Joseph Smith, even though they didn't have, like, the records for it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until about 1970, 1972 that they got some stuff saying, oh, no, it looks like Joseph Smith did ordain some people, or at least was aware of them and didn't do anything about it. And then the first time it pops up in the records that we have is Brigham Young saying something in, like, 1852. And so it wasn't too, when you think of how long the church has been around, it wasn't too long after that that they got some of this historical background that they changed it. And so I'm conflicted because we only have, like, one quote about the ban and not really, like, a full explanation for the purpose of it. So I would hesitate, especially since this has been like over 40 years ago. So it's not something that, it's something people are doing in the past. I get what you say about some of these ideas that have been put forward in the past still going to today. But I'm hesitant about putting in a ton of effort to figure something out that's already been 40 years ago and being able to just say, as opposed to just saying what was taught back then was wrong, and we can't completely, because of our lack of historical sources, we can't completely pin down where it came from, but all the explanations for it were completely wrong. And after all the prayer that President Kimball went through, he and the 12 got rid of the ban, you know, which is where the church is at right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm just very hesitant to try and speak on behalf of something back in 1852 where you have like one or two quotations on it, and that's your entire historical record on where it came from, you know?
Okay, so what do you mean by like speak on behalf of it?
Like for the church to say, yes, Brigham Young put this in only because he was racist 100%, and like make that a big issue, like say that at General Conference and all that. I just don't, like saying that just based on two quotes that somebody else wrote down that Brigham Young said, and then something that's been not a part of church doctrine or practice for over 40 years, like to spend that amount of time and energy to do that just seems off balance to me, you know?
I understand what you're saying. So you're saying that because there's so little information on the priesthood ban and where it came from, it doesn't make a lot of sense to, I guess, dig into why it happened and to really like speak on it much now. Is that?
Yeah. Like I'm fine with like, if we find more stuff, that would be great. But just like with what we have now, is it really that big of a priority to decide what somebody 130 something years ago thought about something? Or can't we just be fine to say it's been done for 40 something years and we're past it now?
I would say that yes, it is a big deal because, the church, I mean, in the Doctrine and Covenants, we're commanded to keep records. And not just in the Doctrine and Covenants, I mean, in the Book of Mormon, Nephi, they have to go back to Jerusalem to obtain records to keep with them, right? So record keeping has always been a huge part of the church. So the fact that there are no records of this event, with all the records that we have, all the archival history and everything that we have, every revelation we've ever received is written down, is documented in the Doctrine and Covenants. We've got the church archive vaults. So the fact that there is no... there's no written revelation should further solidify the idea that this was not from God. And it needs to be made clear that it wasn't, because for the longest time, it was taught that it was something that was ordained of God. And then multiple apostles and prophets came up with their own philosophies to justify why that was the case. And because they did that, that has an effect on the church today. Right. There are a lot of, you know, not just me, but there are many people who are African-American members of the church who are very hurt by those teachings, not just because of when they happened a long time ago, but because they still affect them today, right? Because we have people like Brother Wilcox who are still promoting some of those ignorant theologies, those ignorant ideas, because they repeat it so often. They've been passed down from generation to generation. And also because outside of the church, among Black people, the church is perceived as a racist white church. And if you look at the leadership of the church, everyone is white. Maybe that would be different if Black people had been allowed to keep the priesthood from 1852 until now, right? Maybe the representation of the church would be very different. But it because that's not the case, it reflects everything else in society. And so to say that the church is, you know, that everybody gets up and says the church is true and the gospel is true and the prophets are, you know, they can never lead us astray. They're never wrong. All those things. It presents a conflict there, right? Obviously, I am a firm believer in the gospel. I study the scriptures. I love the Lord. And I'm still a member of the church, active in everything, Sunday school presidency, right? All of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I also have to reconcile that this church that claims to be this worldwide church, this church that loves everyone, promoted an idea for so long that denied children of God the blessings of salvation. And I have to reconcile that. And then for them to say, you know, oh, just forget about it. Bruce Herman Congress said, forget everything we've said up until this point, right? That doesn't resolve the issue. And that doesn't change the perception of the church outside of the church, right? And so it prevents a lot of Black people today from being baptized into the church because they can't get past those ideas. And where they learn about them, it leads to them leaving the church after being baptized, right? As a missionary, I had the opportunity to baptize several people, and all of them were members of minority group, right? They were all either Latino, African-American, or Hispanic, I guess that's the same thing. But none of them are active members of the church anymore. And a lot of them left because of these kinds of doctrinal inconsistencies or these issues within the church, right? And obviously, there could be other reasons for that too. But in my communications with them, a lot of the reasons they left is because of how they felt they were viewed, how they felt they were treated within the church. And a lot of it goes back to these kinds of ideas.
Mm-hmm. You brought your mission into this. And there was something on my mission that was really surprising to me because I went to Ghana and then I went to Sierra Leone. So obviously there are zero white people there at all, except for the missionaries. And then maybe some WHO people doing some work over there on stuff. It's like the only people I saw. And so I went over there and expected two things to be a problem: the race and the priesthood thing and tithing, because they don't have a lot of money when we're teaching the people. So I expected these to be a problem. The main concern that I got from people: why don't you play drums in your church? And as I went on my mission, nobody ever brought it up as a concern. And I met people that were in Ghana when the 1978 revelation came. You know, you had these groups of people, sometimes thousands of people, who were kind of practicing, I guess you could say, as if they were in the church. They had a couple of Book of Mormons. They had a couple of pamphlets. They did get together on Sundays in a building that they'd obtained somehow and teach each other. And, you know, the church is not baptizing them, not sending missionaries over there because they wouldn't be able to have branch presidents or anything among their own population. So they're just kind of off by themselves. You could argue that they were the most marginalized because at least people in the United States had other members of the church and could attend the services, that kind of stuff. But regardless, so when they would tell me about it, they only talked about how amazing it was that day and how many people have gone baptized since. And look, now we have a temple. And I wasn't trying to, because I came into Africa expecting like, oh, this is probably going to be a problem. I should think about how to talk to people about this. And it never was. So my idea, well, except for one guy, but he was like a pastor from another church and was really antagonistic about everything. Mm-hmm. So I kind of put that off to the side. So I've just kind of got this idea that I think the way we talk about race in the United States has been twisted and kind of warped, and it's being used for political purposes so often. And we're just not having the kind of measured, balanced, fact-based approach to it that we could have. And I just can't understand why it would be such a big problem here and then like not a problem at all the people in Africa if there wasn't something wrong in the U.S. with the way that we're looking at this. You know what I mean?
I do, yeah. I definitely agree with you that the way we look at race in America is an issue. And that is mainly because of the way that white people in America look at race, right? There's this idea of like a good and bad binary, right? And racism is on that binary. So it's like, well, I can't be a racist because racism is bad. Because mm-hmm. that's the way it's been shown to us, right? When we think, when we ask people to define racism or think about racism, we think about slavery. We think about the violence of the civil rights movement. We think about the KKK, right? So those are the things that we associate with racism. And so when Black people try to have a conversation with people about race, it becomes a political issue because people are saying, oh, no, I'm a good person. I can't be racist. And if you're, you know, if you're saying that I'm racist, then you're just trying to, you know, you're trying to slander me or you're trying to cancel me or you're trying, you know, all these different ideas. The truth is that, like I said earlier, racism has many forms and it evolves. Right? There's institutional racism, meaning that there's racism built into the systems of the government, right? And that's I mean, that's not something that's based on opinion. That's factual, because literally America was built on the backs of slaves. Right? For the longest time, black people could not vote. That was a law. It wasn't something that somebody just said, oh, I don't want black people to vote. It was a law. And then after that, things were put in place to prevent them from being able to vote properly. There was the grandfather test, the paper bag test. They had those crazy voting rights tests. So there, you know, racism has evolved quite a bit over the years to turn into more than just violence. But the way that people look at it in America, especially white people, is that if you are racist, you're automatically bad. And if you're not racist, then you're good. But the thing is, I've met a lot of good people who are also very racist. And I've met a lot of good people who, you know, who understand, who may be a little bit ignorant of things, but they're seeking to learn. They're seeking to ally themselves with people who are marginalized. And so, you know, in regards to talking about race in the priesthood in Africa, one thing that's important to understand is that the African experience is very, very different from the African-American experience or the Black American experience, right? In Africa, they're not minorities, right? Everyone in Africa is, you know, from the same race, so to speak, right? You know, if we're going to call it race, everyone there is African for the most part. In America, you've got kind of, you know, a melting pot, right? There's different races. But then there's also the issue of how white people in America have created a system in which they are the ones on top. And there are a lot of people who will say, oh, well, you know, I don't have this or I can't get this, and therefore I'm not on top of this. And of course, there are people who are poor, who are not on top of the system. But if you look at the top levels of government, the top levels of business, almost everybody is white and male. Right, because that's the way the system has been built up. It's not because they were special or they worked hard to get to where they are, which I'm sure they did, but they also had many things that helped get them there. Right, and so when you combine that history of all those building blocks that have prevented black people from getting the same opportunities as white people, when you combine that with the history of the church and how they adopted some of those similar practices of racism within the church, then that creates a different conversation here in the United States than it would in Africa, because we already have to deal with American racism. And then on top of that, as a member of the church, we have to deal with the church's racism as well and how that's also been unaddressed. Does that kind of answer what you were...
No, like, I do totally get what you're saying. I guess if I were to break it down and try to say it really simply, you might say that people in Africa don't have as much of a problem with it because they currently aren't dealing with racism on a day-to-day basis like blacks here are. So maybe blacks in America are more sensitized in a way so that issues that might not be issues in Africa become issues based on the environment that they are in here. Is that what you're trying to...
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Okay. I would... We don't have, like, a ton of time, so I don't want to go off on a ton of rabbit trails of addressing this, but I do have a problem with this idea that there's a structure that has been sustained until today of a racial hierarchy. Certainly back in the day with slavery and all that, and even the Jim Crow era, but we're over 60 years, or I should say about 60 years past all of the legislative impositions of this law, of these hierarchies. And even now, the only legislative impositions onto race are those in favor of minorities with affirmative action laws. So those are the only laws on the book that you can discriminate against somebody based on their race. And in this case, it would be discriminate against white people in favor of other races. We see at Harvard right now, you can get in with a lower test score on your SAT if you're black, and then next is white, and then the hardest is Asian. You have to have the highest score if you're Asian. So there's actual what you could call discrimination. Some people define racism to mean people in a position, perceived to be in a position of power, can't be racist against. But if we're going with the classical definition of discrimination, that's the only legal form of it that exists these days. And there's a famous black economist, I don't know if you know him, Thomas Sowell. Yeah, he's a world-renowned. He got his PhD from a guy who won the Nobel Prize in Economics. He's pretty old now. Unfortunately, he's going to pass away soon. He's like 90. But I just finished a book by him called Discrimination and Disparities. And basically, the whole premise of this book is just because you see a disparity doesn't mean that there's discrimination based on prejudice involved. And he goes through a lot of different examples on why he believes this case. And then he also brings up issues with words like privilege, because he's saying it's a post facto is being used to describe an ex ante, meaning that you say somebody's privileged as if it was born that way, but you only say that after the outcomes have happened. So it's only after I'm successful with something, then people go back and say, oh, it's because you had privilege. And then if somebody's unsuccessful, you say, oh, it's because you didn't have privilege, but you're not taking into account that people can start at the same level and then end up at different levels. You're just assuming that whoever started on top had to start on top and ended on the bottom had to start on the bottom. And so I don't see this hierarchy being sustained today. And I want to bring it into what I believe is unhelpful about anti-racist measures, let's say. First of all, what's your opinion on anti-racist type of things where we're talking like affirmative action or paying welfare or low-income housing? Do you think those type of programs and policies are helpful, or do you think they're hurtful?
So first thing I'm going to have you do, because there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah,
first
I'm sorry, thing, I did ramble for a while.
No, you're good. Yeah. I've been talking the whole time, so it's good to hear. So do you have your phone on you?
Yeah.
Okay, if you will, just look up for me really quick. Who benefits the most from affirmative action?
Well, I can... Ibram X. Kendi actually answered that for us already. Because Ibram X. Kendi was complaining about... He said that whites who pretend to be a different race get into college at higher rates than before they pretend to be a different race. And he quickly deleted the tweet because he realized, oh, wait a second, I just admitted that you have to be a race other than white to be advantaged to get into college.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that, but I still want you to look at it really fast.
All right. Ah, okay. We have Vox is the first thing, June 23rd, 2016, and it says white women benefit most from affirmative action and are among its fiercest opponents. White women, affirmative action's biggest beneficiaries. Oh, Washington Post has a slightly different take. Who's benefiting from affirmative action? White men. Affirmative action has helped white women more than anyone. The ironies of affirmative action, Penn Law, legal scholarship. Okay, I think... And we have some of the same stuff going on. So
yeah.
I'm assuming you're going to explain to me why that's why they say that's the case now.
Yeah. So I am not super well versed in why it is that white women are benefiting more from affirmative action. But before affirmative action was put into place, obviously white men were getting the most college admissions. And there was, you know, obviously some serious inequality there. And now, you know, there are more black and brown people applying to universities and colleges, but still not as many as white people, right? And even in the BYU's Equity and Diversity Inclusion Report, they talk about that, you know, how few African-American people are applying as opposed to how many white people are applying. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are differences there. And I would imagine, and, you know, I could be wrong on this, but I would imagine that because of affirmative action and how it is designed to benefit people who are marginalized, because there are more women applying to college and because the majority of those women are white women, they're able to get into college at higher rates than they were before affirmative action. All right. So as far as discriminating based on race, affirmative action is designed to correct that, not to discriminate. And, you know, to a white person, it may seem like, oh, I'm being discriminated against. But what it is it's supposed to correct the discrimination that was already occurring.
You're trying to speed up the balancing of the scales of historical.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's done some good, but it's also created this idea that, oh, black and brown people are not supposed to be here. They just got in because of affirmative action. Right? When I applied to BYU, I got a great score on my ACT. I, you know, had great grades all through high school. But then when I applied And
if you want to brag, you can. No, it's
fine. Yeah, when I applied, I was talking to my friends, and they said, "Oh, well, of course you'll get into BYU. You're black." And I was like, "What's that supposed to mean? You know, no, I've studied just as hard. I have better grades than you do. That's why I'm getting into BYU. It's not because I'm black, right?" And obviously, BYU wouldn't hurt to have a little bit more diversity. I think right now it's like 0.29% of the university is black. There are out of 35,000 students.
I think it might even be lower. I thought it was more like
I don't know the exact math.
1.5%, but
It's below 1% for sure.
Oh, I thought you just said 2.9.
I meant 0.29, right?
So okay.
Very, very low.
Yeah.
There are a total of 410 black students. That includes students who identify as two or more races or as biracial. Mm-hmm. There are 410 out of 35,000 students. That's just black students, right? Obviously, there are other ethnicities. So that's already an issue here. But right, there was that idea that, oh, because I'm black, I get into schools easier than someone else does. I don't have to work as hard, which was not the case. I did my due diligence, and I got into BYU because of my academic ability, right? Not just because I was an African-American. So in that way, it created another racist idea, right?
This
idea.
But it sounds like it was the anti-racist policy that encouraged that. So
it was people's perception of that policy, right?
And
it
there is a case going to the Supreme Court where they're showing that, yeah, if you're black, you need this score for Harvard, for SAT, and then for white, the average score is 200 points higher, and then for Asian, it's 200 points again higher than that.
Okay,
so, totally, if you just, and just like Ibram X. Kendi said, he's the guy who kind of came up with the term anti-racist, just for the people here, you might know this already, he kind of came up with and popularized the term anti-racist with his book, How to Be Anti-Racist, and he's the head of a anti-racist university research group. They've gotten $5 million from Apple, but that's another story. So they've actually shown they have these policies, they have quotas, and I'm not saying this is a bad idea that, oh, we should have more black people, that will help them. And it's because of past historical discriminations that these disparities are helping today. So let's kind of push on the scales a bit to help them get back up to speed on the things they missed out on in the 1800s, or even early 1900s, you could say. But in order to get more equality of outcome, if what's trying to come into the school is very unequal in this way, you have to push on the scales and you have to tweak the way you look at each race. You have to make it less likely for Asians to get in, medium likely for whites to get in, more likely for blacks to get in for the numbers you want to occur. And so that is actual discrimination of opportunity to try and get more equality of outcome. This is the equality versus equity. And you've hit on one of the problems, is that now people have a correct perception that people on average, I'm not saying you specifically, but black people on average are less qualified to be at these universities than other races. So before, if you got in and you were black, yeah, you got in, you were supposed to be there. But now it's there are a couple of people that aren't supposed to be there.
A couple, but here's the thing.
But it's it's an actual thing. There are actual Asians and white people that didn't get in because less qualified black people than them needed to get in. So I completely understand. I do not doubt for a second that you got in because you were qualified. But I'm why would you want this program to be here? I watched a video, and it was a guy who went on college campuses and was talking to students, and he was talking to a girl who was half black. And he asked her, "Do you think you would be here today if it wasn't for affirmative action?" And she said, I'm not sure. And he's like, "So you say you have doubts on whether you're supposed to be here based on your merits or not?" And she's like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Tell me your GPA." And she had a great GPA. She had done all these other activities. She got good college admission scores, but she still had this self-doubt because she knows, and you can't tell her to think otherwise, she knows that it's a fact that some people do get in because of their race and don't actually belong there in the sense that they met the academic standards that everybody else has to meet. And that was it was something that was holding her back, even though she totally wasn't part of that group. So kind of my big thing is when you try to, you have to think about these policies when you implement them, because just saying, oh, we're going to create equal outcomes doesn't mean it's going to happen. Like, all these other unintended consequences can happen. And there's another unintended consequence, especially for these high schools. With affirmative action, the dropout rate for Black people has increased a ton. You could have been just fine to go to, like, a BYU or another perfectly great college, but because of these affirmative action policies, you got into Harvard, and you went to Harvard. But now you're at the bottom of your class. You get discouraged, you drop out. So you could have been, without affirmative action, you could have been a very successful, perfectly great college graduate. With affirmative action, now you're a college dropout.
So I will say that's not just a result of affirmative action. Malcolm Gladwell actually talked about this in his book, David and Goliath. That's pretty consistent across multiple races, right? It varies in percentage. But yes, if you go to a university that that maybe is like a higher academic standard than you are used to or than you are prepared for, then yes, your dropout rate will increase. But that was not just for African-Americans, and it's not a direct result of affirmative action, right? There are a lot of things that go into that.
But I don't see how you, because affirmative action literally is decoupling academic performance and race, and saying that lower academic performances is okay if you are of a different race.
Right, and we also have to acknowledge the fact that there are plenty of minorities and marginalized people who have gone to these universities, who got in, who maybe wouldn't have had a chance to otherwise because of racist discrimination and racist ideologies that existed before affirmative action and probably still do today. They got in and they had an opportunity to excel in a place where they might not have been able to before. You know, have you ever heard of an HBCU? Historically, no. Black colleges and universities.
Oh, okay.
Right?
So, yeah.
You know, there's places like Howard University, Florida and A&M University, Xavier, right? These are all colleges that were created specifically because white people were not allowing Black people into their universities, right? And so the people, they had the chance to go to these universities and to do well and excel in college, right? So affirmative action, it was kind of a Band-Aid, right? It was put there to create... it was put there to create this solution to racial discrimination, to, you know, to kind of correct the policies of the past. And it's been effective in some ways, and in other ways it hasn't been as effective, right? Obviously, there are people of all races, not just marginalized races, but there are people of all races who get into universities that they are not qualified for. There are plenty of legacy students. There are plenty of students who, you know, get in because of their connections, right? It's not necessarily what you know, it's who you know, right? So there are plenty of students who go to universities that they are not qualified to be at. It doesn't just come down to race in that respect. Mm-hmm. You know, and yes, there are definitely some difficulties that come with going to these universities. But, you know, like you said earlier, you acknowledge that I'm qualified to be here. All the people in the Black Student Union, as far as I know, they're all very qualified to be here. And you know, there is a pretty high dropout rate. I read the equity and diversion, the equity report, the DE&I report, and the dropout rate or the graduation rate for African-Americans at this university is 58% compared to 79% for white students, right? But we can't just chalk that up to affirmative action because there are many other factors.
Well, I don't think they're doing that at BYU.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, anywhere. There are many factors that go into the lower graduation rates. Well, there are socioeconomic factors. For instance, a lot of Black people have other issues outside of school that they have to worry about. They have to worry about supporting family. Black students are more likely to be working multiple jobs throughout college to support themselves. Whereas because of income and wealth gaps in America, white students may not have to worry about that as often. I'm not saying that there aren't white students who are paying their way through college as well, but I'm saying it is a more frequent occurrence for marginalized students, right? So you've got that, and maybe there are socioeconomic factors that would prevent a Black person from graduating. There are also psychological factors. There's microaggressions and discrimination that you might face on campus that contribute to that feeling of imposter syndrome, of not feeling like you are welcome in a certain place. We call universities that have greater than, I think, 50% white population, they're called predominantly white universities or predominantly white institutions, right?
PWIs.
So, PWIs, exactly. And that's the opposite of an HBCU, which HBCU is any university that has 50% or more of a Black population.
Okay, so the HBCU isn't a college that's only for black people. It's just that historically it's been over 50%.
So they were created specifically for black students because they were not. So like all
the
all
these in the 1960s with the anti-discrimination laws, you couldn't have segregated schools anymore. So then they became open to everybody.
Well, no, the thing with HBCUs, they were all created, you know, these schools that have been around for a long time, right? Since the 1800s, most of them. And they were created as a way to allow black people to go to college and get an education because they were not allowed at white universities. So HBCUs didn't necessarily, like, when the, you know, when Brown versus Board of Education and all those different rules were passed, it's not like they said, okay, we now welcome white students. It was then that, okay, now we as black students are allowed to go other places besides these HBCUs, right? So most HBCUs definitely have a population of black students significantly over 50%. And then there will be other students there as well, you know, students who are international, students who are Latinx, or there will also be some white students there, not as many, because, again, they tend to serve black populations more often and still give black students the opportunity to go to college where they might not otherwise be able to attend college, right? Because the truth is that not everyone is cut out for an Ivy League education, right? Not everyone is cut out for, you know, an education at an elite school, but everyone needs that opportunity. And that is not to say that HBCUs are, you know, a less qualified education or anything like that. It's just to say that they provide more opportunities for people who might not otherwise get those opportunities. But going back to the issue of graduation rates, here at BYU, I know that there are a lot of students here who have left. I have a lot of friends who have left the university. And it's not because of, you know, the educational aspect. While that is tough, it's because of more the culture of the university, the racism that they experience on campus, the discrimination that they experience from peers, the ignorance that they experience. Those things take a mental and emotional toll on people, and those contribute significantly. And so at any PWI, those factors are going to play a huge role in graduation rates, as well as, you know, the academic difficulty, the socioeconomic issues, all those kinds of things. So we can't just chalk that up to affirmative action and say that, oh, because we are now allowing people who might not have had a chance to get into the school to go to the school, that's why they're dropping out. Because there are plenty of people who have been able to go to these prestigious universities who might not have had a chance to otherwise and do extremely well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it just seems like those people would have gone to those universities in the first place. Like, somebody who's going to succeed at a university, who's qualified and stuff, would have already gotten in without affirmative action. There was an example, you talked about historically black colleges and universities. There was a black high school in the Washington, D.C. area. Started, I think, in the late 1800s, and it's called Dunbar High School. And it was only for blacks. It wasn't like a private, you know, you pay tons of money to send your kids to the school. It was this, it was like a charter school or something, but you got into it by raffle. So parents were like, oh, I want my kid to go there. They had like amazing test scores. They had better test scores than the predominantly white and Asian schools in the same area, and then way better than the predominantly black high schools in the D.C. area. D.C. is not known for academic excellence, unfortunately, especially among minorities. But this school did super well. And Thomas Sowell, this is the economist again, he pinpointed on, well, it was the raffle. Because just the simple fact that you lived in a family in a situation where your parents wanted a good education for you enough to put you in this raffle for this good school was enough of a sorting mechanism that the people that were going to do well with their opportunity went to that school and then did amazingly afterwards. And then, unfortunately, when the anti-discrimination laws were put in place, everything had to be desegregated, even things that were black-only places. And so Dunbar went back to just being a normal public high school, picking kids up from the area, and it just tanked like crazy right after that. And so he's trying to point out that you can't just like grab people and pull them into better opportunities there, because at the college level, when you're measuring these disparities, he says we often make this incorrect assumption that the discrimination is happening where the disparity happens. But you actually also refuted this. You said maybe there's they're more likely to have things in their just life situation before they got to college that's going to make it harder for them to perform well, possibly. And that's what could lead to these higher dropout rates. So if we've kind of both admitted that there's things that have happened before you got to college that might damage your ability to perform well in college, how in the world is trying to address it at the college admissions level going to fix any of the things that came before, you know? So it's a complicated problem, and I just, maybe we can agree on this. I hate it when people of the anti-racist ilk act as if these solutions are super simple. Like, oh, hiring discrimination. Well, we just have to mandate that you have to hire the correct amount of people. Thomas Sowell goes into a whole thing about that and explains how it actually makes companies want to run away from predominantly black areas because there's more lawsuits that can happen if you're in a black space, a predominantly black neighborhood that, or even a higher percentage of neighborhood, and then your employees just happen to not have a higher percentage of black people for whatever reason. And so they're scared of that, and they run away to another place. Then affirmative action, like, oh, well, there's a disparity in the schools. We just need to mandate that the schools have more equal representation of the races that reflects the population. Well, now you're bringing in a lot of people that can't handle Harvard but could have totally handled BYU, and now they're dropping out. Well, now we just need to mandate that we give them a certain amount of money when they're young. It's like, well, that doesn't address the fact that they spend half as much time studying as their white counterparts. And it also now encourages fatherlessness in the homes because you don't need a provider there if the government's going to provide for you. So I'm just like, it's so sad how people just think if you call it anti-racist and it sounds like it might work possibly, that that's all the research you need to do into that topic and you don't need to look at what effects are happening because of these things. Do you understand what I'm trying to get at here?
I understand what you're saying. I think that your definition of anti-racism is convoluted a little bit there, right? So
is it okay if I clarify a little bit?
Absolutely, yeah, please.
Ibram X. Kendi, because people say anti-racism means you're trying to not be racist. I'm like, yeah, that totally makes sense.
It's more than that, yeah.
But, yeah, I'm saying other people say that. But in How to Be Anti-Racist, which popularized this term, Ibram X. Kendi said that in order to address racism, he said past discrimination needs to be addressed with present discrimination. And present discrimination needs to be addressed with future discrimination. And then he also proposed an office in the federal government that whenever there's any disparity of outcomes that happens in any law or policy or anything, that office has the authority to override all other government mechanisms and go in and balance things out with basically whatever means necessary. So when he's saying anti-racist, it's very much everything. Every single outcome needs to be what I determine to be equitable and equal, or we need to use government power to go in and mess with things and tweak it. And he also said that racism is inherently linked to capitalism. Capitalism is inherently linked to racism. They came from the same mother, and they're both corrupt siblings. Or it was something like that. He kind of went poetic with it. So these are the things that Kendi's putting forward. Anti-racism, as popularized by him, I think he came up with the term. I might be wrong. But so when you're trying to get in the very technical sense of anti-racism, you're talking about this anti-capitalism, government control, equality of outcome for everything, or else it needs to be fixed with more government control and anti-capitalism.
Okay. So to simplify anti-racism is simply the opposition of racism. It's not just you know, to be anti-racist, you can't just be not racist. You have to be opposed to racism.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. And so the reason that, you know, I'm not entirely familiar with How to Be an Anti-Racist. I've read some of it, not all of it, right? So I can't claim to be an expert on Dr. Kendi.
You've probably read more than me. Because those quotes are like the famous quotes because they sound so crazy. So
You know, they do sound extreme. But the thing is, what he's proposing is not, I mean, it's controversial. It's very idealistic. But it is not unreasonable what he's proposing. Because the thing is, everything that he's proposing is the opposite of something that's already been done. All right, if you think about it, you know, American capitalism began with the slave trade, Right? They decided we're going to capitalize.
But capitalism didn't begin with the slave trade.
No, it didn't. But American capitalism is built different than like the rest of the world's capitalism. Right. So the thing with American capitalism is that it began with capitalizing on human beings, right? They tried it with Native Americans, but it didn't work because there were not enough Native Americans. So they went to Africa and they took people from Africa, and then they invented this idea, which is kind of like the beginning of racism. They invented this idea that, oh, these people are inferior to us, therefore they need our help and they need to be, you know, taught and trained in this specific way. And so they justified this inhumane treatment of African people, brought them to the United States, forced them to work for free, and did this for 400 years, roughly, right? And so in that way, white people got a 400-year start in the United States, right? So the reason that Ibram Kendi says that capitalism and racism are kind of from the same place is because they are, right? Obviously, capitalism didn't begin with the slave trade, but that is where it got its modern start. Right, is with the slave trade because.
But specifically American?
Yeah, American capitalism, yeah.
Well, only about.
I guess you can say European capitalism then, because, you know, it started with like the British and the Spaniards and the Portuguese, you know, and they're the ones that brought people to America. But America built its wealth, built its empire, and everything off of the backs of slavery, capitalizing off of human beings.
Only about 3.6% of the slaves taken out of Africa went to the United States, though. Like, over half of them went to the Middle East, and they still have them there in the Middle East today. So I don't see how this is an American thing. And even, they have, like, the slave castle in Cape Coast, Ghana. We went and toured it. Everybody knows that it's there. And they talk about, yeah, your tribe would team up with the Europeans, and now you're more powerful, and now you can go grab people from the other, you know, the Fantes didn't like the trees, and they didn't like the Ewes in Nigeria. So you go and grab that other tribe that you've been warring with for a couple hundred years, hand them off to the Europeans, and they ship them off to wherever. And only 3.6% of them go to the United States. And then in the United States, only a very small percentage of the population there actually own slaves. So I don't think that the whole economic system in America uniquely was built entirely off of, you know, I think that's way too many assumptions and generalizations to.
I disagree because, okay. I mean, if you look at, I mean, there's so many things to dig into, but slavery, I mean, yes, a small percentage of the population owned slaves. However, there were millions of slaves here and they did 400 years of free labor, right? They grew cotton, they grew rice, they grew sugarcane, all these different things. And those things were shipped around the world, right? It created a lot of capital for the United States, right? And then, you know, eventually the Industrial Revolution hit and, you know, the early 1800s or mid 1800s. And then we start to see an insurgence of, you know, of factories and things like that in the North. But still, they were getting their supplies. A lot of the, you know, the things that they produced in those factories from Southern slaves, right? And so I don't understand how you can say that 400 years of free labor is not, like, I mean, that's pretty significant.
But right? And I wasn't saying that they didn't provide any economic benefit. I'm just saying that America uniquely didn't become an economic power, the economic powerhouse it is from slavery. That, I mean, that'd be kind of difficult to do since 3.6% went to America and the rest went to tons of other places.
But it would, though. So here's the thing. 3.6, you say 3.6%, but that's still a significant amount of people. It was millions of slaves.
I was just specifically pushing back on America's unique in this way. What America was unique on was freeing the slaves.
Slavery is very different in America.
They still have it in Ghana.
I don't know anything about that.
Well, they do.
But child also, slavery. Ghana's not a world superpower. And I'm sure that, like, you know, the way that they do slavery there, I don't know anything about that. So I can't say.
It's more children, but yeah.
Okay. I mean, so I don't know anything about that. But I do know that slavery in the United States was very different than slavery in other parts of the world. And the way that they used slaves here to make money and to capitalize off of all the free labor that they were getting was very, very monumental in the building up of the United States as it is. Like, those original 13 colonies just about all of them had slaves doing all of their work, right? Making all of their money, producing all of their, you know, their exports and imports and things like that. And so, I mean, what else would have built America? Like, what else would have built the economic power that we had here?
Well, just like capitalism in and of itself.
What do you mean?
Well, because a person going out and working on a field for forever is going to produce a certain amount of labor. But somebody who has the economic freedom to invent the cotton gin is going to, that one idea from that one person is going to produce way more than hundreds and hundreds of slaves working on the farms.
You do know that the cotton gin was not invented by Eli Whitney, right?
I didn't even know that his name.
Yeah, so Eli Whitney, he's the one that has the patent for the cotton gin, but it was actually invented by one of his slaves.
Capitalism.
To make their lives easier. And then he took that and he used that to make himself a whole bunch of money, because that slave didn't get anything. He didn't even get credit, right?
Yeah.
So, because, I mean, what purpose would a white man have to say, I want to make work easier for my slaves? It doesn't make any sense if you think about it.
Well, no, they want, production went up, though, after the cotton gin.
Yeah, exactly. Production went up, but it also made things a little bit easier for the slaves. They didn't have to separate everything by hand.
Well, right? I know, but he did.
I see what you're saying, though. Yeah, I understand the point. Yeah, it could increase production. So, yeah, that question, out of pocket. But,
and, I mean, the U.S. wasn't even a world superpower till 80 years after slavery's all gone. I don't think, like, and even in the Civil War, the North was the one that was the economic powerhouse. Like, I know that you, and I totally acknowledge that you said that they were getting economic benefits from the South, but you would think that if most of the economic benefit of slaves was happening in the South, they would be the economic powerhouse during the Civil War once they cut off trade, not the North being the powerhouse of economics. So, I mean, that's mostly what wars are won on, and the North won because they were just better at, like, everything.
So, I mean, things were changing, right? Obviously, industry was becoming, you know, the next big thing at that time. And so, yes, in that respect, they were a powerhouse. That's where the government was situated. And so, you know, those kinds of big political decisions and things, yes, were being made there. However, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. A big reason that the North was able to win the war was because they stopped using resources from the South. And so the South had nowhere to send their resources, or not as many places to send their resources. And so they didn't have the capital to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
but the North got their resources from somewhere then that wasn't coming from slavery, and they were able to absorb it pretty well.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that.
I'm not deep into the economics of the Civil War either, but I mean, the North won, so
right.
Like something was. If the South had millions and millions of slaves, and the North has about zero, and you're positing that slaves were a major economic force in the United States, it just seems kind of odd that the outcome would be a decisive North victory.
So,
you know. Because the war is, I mean, you have smart generals and everything, but war is almost entirely a arms race, a production race, an economic race, especially when you're in total war like the United States was.
Right.
You know?
So, you have to remember
I think
that.
You have to go now. Do you? It's 1:30?
Yeah, it's about time for me to head out.
Okay.
Just one last thought. So the reason that...
I'm not like, because you can't explain this well, your arguments are wrong or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like,
this is this, you know, this is new train of thought for me. But going back to it, so yes, slaves were an economic powerhouse, but only as long as what they were doing could be used, right? And so it was in the end a decisive North victory, but I mean, it took a while. Like, it wasn't like the North was always just going to win this war. It was a struggle.
Battle of Gettysburg was a very critical tipping point.
Ulysses S. Grant was monumental in, you know, his strategy and everything was monumental in bringing that war to an end, just like George Washington in the Revolutionary War, right? That was the same thing.
Yeah.
Kind of ragtag, but they managed to win it through strategy and inspiration, right? The South began to fall apart during the Civil War because, yes, they had all these slaves, and they were doing all of this work, but they no longer had a source of income from the North, right? As far as where the North got all of their money from, I don't know much about the imports, the exports, yeah. things mm-hmm. like that, but I do know that
for the and there was like time, foreign yeah. powers, like, oh, are the French going to ally with these people? And, exactly. you know, there was that whole thing going on.
And,
so.
And also, you know, we say that, oh, Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves out of the goodness of his heart, but really it was a strategical decision. He freed the slaves because he knew that that would, again, undercut the South's ability to produce resources, to make money, and to win the war. And so that was a big decision, or that was a big part of him making that decision to free slaves, was so that they wouldn't have anyone to work for them anymore, they wouldn't be able to make any more money, so on and so forth. But as far as American capitalism goes, and as far as all of that goes, your slaves built the United States. Literally, the universities that we go to, a lot of the buildings were built by people who were slaves. A lot of the people, like even on this campus, Abraham Smoot, he owned slaves, right? So we have a building named after that guy. And you can't take any part of our history and separate it from racism, separate it from slavery, because it's all just kind of built in together, because that's how it began. It began with slavery, right? At the same time that, you know, the settlers landed on Plymouth Rock, there were slaves there too, right? Ready to work. So with that being said, I enjoyed our discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 I mean, there's so many more things you could talk about.
And, a lot more. Yeah.
And I do really appreciate this. I think it's crucial, like I mentioned you in our Instagram story, I've tried to reach out to several different people, mm-hmm. and they either just ghosted me or blocked me or said, oh, we don't want to talk about that. We don't feel qualified to talk about that. And so it's nice to see that you can have a disagreement with people and agreement. I think, obviously, yeah. the church, the reasons that they gave, the slavery of the past, the Jim Crow laws, all that stuff, very messed up, very wrong, not in line with us being all children of God together. I think mostly what we agree on is to the extent it plays a role today, and then also the policies that will best address it and help us all become more equal in the future. Mm-hmm. And so obviously we still agree, but that's kind of the point, is that you can talk and have a discussion with people that you disagree with.
Absolutely.
Do it respectfully, listen to each other. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm going to go and Google some, what is this whole affirmative action with white women thing after this yeah. type of thing. And maybe you're going to, I don't know what you're going to look at, but you know, maybe it will give each other ideas and we can develop our thought processes more.
For sure. Yeah.
And yeah.
I just want to say, like, I'm always willing to have conversations with people who are really willing to have a conversation. I really appreciate you inviting me to do this. Mm-hmm. I think it's like you said at the beginning, a lot of people make race very political, and it's not. It's not a political issue. It's a human issue, right? And so I think that the ability to have a conversation about it, to disagree, to learn new things is huge. And I think we really do need to take the politics out of race, meaning that we just need to talk about it as what it is. That doesn't mean that there shouldn't be political decisions mm-hmm. to correct some of the wrongs of racism. But, you know, when talking about racism, if people say, oh, well, that person is, you know, they want to talk about racism, so they're a liberal, and they don't want to, you know, they want to not see color, so they're a conservative, or whatever, you know, whatever the stereotype or mm-hmm. the prejudice might be. We need to get rid of that mindset and just have the mindset of, okay, let's talk about these issues. Let's hear each other's opinions, figure out where the disconnects are, figure out where the false perceptions are, figure out the truth, and then create solutions based on those truths.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, thanks.
I appreciate you, Luke.
I appreciate it very much, Nathaniel. No, you like to go by Nate.
Yeah,
Nate Bird, thank you very much, and that's it.